How are you? That tells you I come from the Bronx. And one of our claims to fame is that we don't have an accent. I'm very partial to the Bronx. I feel about the Bronx the way Brigham Young felt about Salt Lake City, Utah. This is the right place. However, the Bronx has some great distinction. In the Bronx, there is a restaurant, and on the wall, there is a plaque. And the plaque says there are two places in the world that have the in front of them. One is the Bronx, and the other is the Vatican. And I'm associated with both of those places, give or take, a little bit here and there. I was humbled and deeply moved when Marcy called me a good few 24 hours ago now and asked me, would I share my experience, strength, and hope at this conference on this day? And after I hung up from speaking with Marcy, I sat for a few moments and I said, you know, Maurice, there was a time when people stopped inviting you. I used to go anyway. And then I'd make a 30-day retreat wondering why they didn't invite me back. And so I thank you for inviting me to come and be with you to share my experience, strength, and hope. I thank each of you for coming to be with me on this, the most important day of my life. It's not my birthday. It's not the anniversary of anything in particular in my life. It's just simply the only day I have. And when people come to be with you at such a significant time in your life, like the only day you have, I try to remember them. And I will try to remember you because you are here with me on this, the most important day of my life. There are words that come from an Irish song, and they say, the cares of tomorrow will wait until this day is done. However, it's not the anniversary of anything in particular in my life, but I think you should know this. I think it's good to know things like this. Today's the birthday of Thomas Edison. And Thomas Edison said, you know, don't worry about whether things are going to come out all right. Jonah got out all right. And something else about Thomas Edison, he came home from school one day at the age of 6, and he had a note from his teacher. And the teacher said that he should be taken out of school, that he wasn't going to make it. I could identify with that in my own life. Is this microphone okay? The bishop was making his rounds, And he had been to several churches on visitation, and he was finishing up. And at the last church, he was going to finish the visitation with Mass, and they told him there would be a delay. There was something the matter with the microphone. So he patiently waited for them to fix the microphone. Finally, they gave him the word that the mic was fixed, and he got up to begin Mass, and he knew when he got up there was something the matter with the mic. He said, "There's something the matter with the microphone." And the congregation responded, "And also with you." I'm also reminded, as I look around here this morning, these stories come to me in certain circumstances about the preacher who was going to give his first sermon. And he arrived very early to the church. He was very nervous. And it was a farming section of our country. And he was pacing up and down. The church bell was ringing, and it was time for him to go in and give his sermon. And there was only one farmer in the pew. So he went down to the farmer, and he said, "You know, what do you think? I'm supposed to give my first sermon, and you're the only one who has come." And the farmer said, "Well, if I had a load of hay, and I went out to feed the cows, and only one cow showed up, I'd feed the cow." The preacher said, "You got it." Up into the pulpit he goes. An hour or so later, he finishes. He comes down. He says to the farmer, "What'd you think?" The farmer said, "Well, if I had a load of hay, and I went out to feed the cows, and only one cow showed up, I don't think I'd give him the whole load." Now, if you didn't get the point of the story, you could talk to your sponsor. And if you don't have a sponsor, well, as Paul Harvey would say, you know the rest of the story. I stand in awe at this moment of God's love for me. I stand in awe of you and my relationship with you. There's another Irish saying, and it says, "In the shelter of each other, people live." How blessed am I to be in the marvelous and wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. How blessed am I at this particular moment to be amongst women. I stand in awe at this moment of Maurice. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a woman. I'm a member of a religious community. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. In particular, the Forest Hills Group in Queens, New York. And incidentally, my name is Sister Maurice. Thank you. One of the things that I'm partial to in our fellowship is that it's a fellowship of equals. There are no titles in Alcoholics Anonymous. No one really cares what you do for a living. I like all of that. And yet, you've never been anything else in this fellowship other than Sister Maurice. Now, isn't that somewhat of a title? Well, for me, it's my name. It's the name I've been using most of my life. It's on all my important papers. It's on my driver's license. It's also written up quite well in two police stations in the city of New York. But moreover, it's the name I gave to you when I came into your beautiful presence a while back now. A call had been made for me, and I was supposed to go to the Forest Hills group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wasn't quite sure that someone of my class and caliber should be going to such a place as AA. I was not a happy camper when I came. I went to keep some people in my life off my case. And I figured I'll go and do this for a few days, and they'll all go back into the foxholes, and I'll be able to get on with my life. Today, I choose to live the AA way of life. And that's the way I speak of it. I no longer say, I have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I prefer to see it as I choose to live the AA way of life. And when I talk about something being a way of life, it's not something I do when the Spirit moves me. It's not an incidental experience. A way of life to me is as much a part of me as my right hand and my left hand. Alcoholics Anonymous for me is my launching pad. And it is from that point that I get to do whatever God assigns me on any given day. But I went to this first meeting, and I went up the stairs and down the stairs and into a little room that we have there, and a fellow jumped right up, and he came right over, and he gave me a handshake like I hadn't had in quite a while. And he told me who he was, and he said, what's your name? I said, me? He said, yeah, what's your name? I said, I'm Sister Maurice. Now, this fellow didn't say, well, we're going to have a group conscience meeting. I'll get back to you. Nor did he say to me, your mother doesn't call you that, does she? The very next thing he said was, hi, Sister Maurice, you're welcome. And in my over 24 years with you, a day at a time, no one has even suggested that I call myself anything else. The other beautiful thing that happened with that gentleman was he used that beautiful sense of touch with me. He let his hand touch mine in a handshake. And I was very moved by that. Because at that point in Maurice's life, people were not interested in touching me. They talked to me from across the room behind closed doors, called me up on the telephone, wrote me poison pen letters. And here I arrive among strangers, so I thought. And those two very beautiful things happen. Somebody wants to know my name, and somebody uses that beautiful sense of touch with me. Well, the name is important, but the most important thing about me at any point on a clock is what I told you first and foremost, that I am an alcoholic. And each time that I say that, beginning first when I come to in the morning, I announce before God that I am an alcoholic. And any time thereafter that I say it, I am reminded that of all the things I do each day that God gives me, my most important job, work, task, assignment is that I stay sober. And I do that best through the principles and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous as they have been written. When I came to you a while back, you gave me a book, and you called it big. I thought it was an interesting way that you described the book. I had cleared up enough to see that it wasn't a small book. I was also teaching first grade at the time, and in first grade, you teach the word big, and you teach sizes and shapes to the children. And I could see that this was not a small book, but it was a big book. And the book was so big that the gal who gave it to me, she was much shorter than I was, she held it in two hands and she said to me, "Here is a big book." And I truly believe there are no coincidences, no accidents. And just at that moment, as I was taking the book from her, I looked over her shoulder and my eye caught a sign on the wall and it said, "Keep it simple." And I said to myself, "Wow. Do these people practice what they preach?" Because you can't get much simpler than that. Here is a big book. Of course, now we have the paperback, which I call the small big book. I don't just call it the small book because there are other books out there on the shelves in the regular bookstores. One of them is called the small book, and I wouldn't want us to get confused. So I call ours the small big book. Well, you know, you introduce anything new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they send for you. And this fellow came to me one night, and he was pacing up and down, and he had a small big book, and he was pouncing on it, and he said, you know, he said, "Sister," he said, "you call this the small big book?" I thought he was paying me a compliment. I said, "Oh, I do." And he said, "You know, that's a contradiction." I said, "What do you mean, contradiction?" He said, "Small, big." I thought for just a moment. And I said, "Well, we have had jumbo shrimp for years." Well, anyway, I took the book from you, the one that you called big, and this is what you said to me. You told me I should try. And that's a key word in my life, try. You told me I should try to live my life based on what is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you told me that was part one. And then you told me the other part was I should try to live my life based on what is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to do that with the people who know how to do it best, the people in the rooms. And so I try, with your help, to live my life based on what is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is an ongoing process with me. I try. I spent a lot of time, started when I was a little kid in the South Bronx, with checklists, success list, and the failure list. I didn't have too much on the success side. I had a lot on the failure side. And then I projected that onto God because I didn't know any better. And I thought he had the same kind of list. And there wasn't too much on the success side. And there was a lengthy list on the failure side. And I don't see it that way anymore. Because I don't believe the God that I relate to today, the God that you taught me about, I don't believe he's interested in success or failure, but I believe he very much blesses the effort. I try with your help, and without your help, I will have no success at all. I don't know that from personal experience because I have yet to leave you. But I know it well from the experiences of others. The little sheep stays with the flock for one reason and one reason only, self-preservation. and the little sheep that strays from the flock. You know, the little sheep that says, oh, I know I've been missing meetings. We must get together. Oh, I'm doing fine. Wait till I tell you about my new relationship. Wait till I tell you how the kids are doing. Wait till I tell you about the new job. Don't worry about me. I'm doing fine. You know, the little sheep that strays from the flock. That's the one that's found in the ditch and over the embankment and hanging from the barbed wire fence. I have a drunkologue that would tell you quite well that all by myself, I can stay very sick and quite drunk. I don't need anyone to help me to do that. But I truly believe I cannot stay sober and fairly well without you. Alcohol became a way of life for me in a very short period of time. It dictated my moods and it made my decisions and it said you will, Maurice, and it said you won't. Things that I thought I put the final stamp of approval on, not when the first drink of alcohol came into my body, mind, and spirit. I was a first grade teacher at the time, and I would be working very hard with my kids at 10 o'clock in the morning, and something would start in my body, mind, and spirit, and it wouldn't be saying, don't you have to go out to the bathroom, don't you need a cup of coffee? It would be screaming in there, you need a drink. And the very next thought that would come would be, I'm not leaving these children at 10 o'clock in the morning to go drinking. And so I would put up against that screaming what people told me I had so much of, willpower. And the willpower approach was futile. And I went on to learn, not that I was a weak-willed individual, but rather because I was a sick, untreated alcoholic, it went beyond the strength of my will to do other than to satisfy with what was going on with this disease. And not wanting to feel guilty about this, I would look at the watch again and I would say, well, these kids can go out to the bathroom, then they can have their snack. I'll get the teacher next door to keep an eye on them. Because after all, I am a responsible teacher. And then I'll go over to the convent, get a drink, and I'll be back when this is all over. Yeah. And I'd be running across the yard to the convent and I'd be saying this. This is going to be my last drink, at least until I've done my day's work. With all that I have learned about the disease of alcoholism and continue to learn about it, the most fascinating thing I have learned is that it's the first drink. And I was too sick to recall at that time that at 5 o'clock in the morning when the big bell went off to get us into our day, my story goes back to old God's time before we went mod. And we had this bell that rang at 5 in the morning. And for me to get into anything in those days, I had to reach over and take a drink. And each time I did that, I said, this is going to be the last one. At least until I've done my day's work. And yet, during the course of my active alcoholism, if you were to meet me along the street and you would say, Sister Maurice, question, who or what is the center of your life? I would have been insulted by the question. Because you should have known by the title. You should have known by the particular dress I wore at that time called habit uniform. You just saw me come out of that building called convent and you're asking me, who is the center of my life? How come you don't know that the center of my life is God? And I would have been insulted by your question. Today I choose to live honestly as best I can, thanks to you. And I have no problem in sharing with you that somewhere along the journey, the focus had shifted. And it shifted from God to that next drink. And I justified the use of alcohol in my life. It was not one of my goals in life to become an alcoholic. I don't recall getting up a dark and gloomy day, bright and sunny day, and saying, today's the day, Alky, by 6 o'clock tonight, watch me. I do not see alcoholism as self-inflicted. That's my opinion. I believe it's a disease that comes to a person. I don't hold myself responsible for the sickness that came to me. I think it's a marvelous and wonderful idea that we have steps that suggest to us that we make amends because we are accountable. But I do hold myself very responsible for the gift of sobriety that has been given to me. I did not get sober. I use that expression for a long time. I got sober, you got sober, he got sober, she got sober. I don't see it that way anymore. My opinion, I don't believe a person can get sober. I believe something bigger, greater, well, they call it a miracle, takes place in a person's life. And I believe the gift, the very precious gift of sobriety, is given. And through the principles and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and doing it with you, the people in the rooms, I have maintained and taken care of the precious gift a day at a time. And so I hold myself very responsible for the gift of sobriety that has been given to me. So much so that if you should ever hear, as you continue on your journey, if you should ever hear that Maurice is back drinking, please, please don't call me a victim. Call me a volunteer. And the very next thing you should say about me is somewhere along the line, she wasn't willing to do everything necessary to stay sober. I cannot plead ignorance today. You have taught me and taught me well how to take care of the precious gift of sobriety each day that God gives me. My first prayer of the morning is the Lord's Prayer. When I come to in the morning and I announce before God that I am an alcoholic, that immediately puts me on the right wavelength. It sets the tone up here for me. And then I say the Lord's Prayer. And when I reach the part of the prayer that says, give us this day our daily bread, he will not refuse anyone who asks for the bread. But he only gives it for the day, sufficient for the day. You know, we've had some difficult weather back there in the east. There's this white stuff that came rather forcefully, and we didn't know what to do with it. You know, and I travel a lot, and I'd be listening when I asked for the bread to see if he was going to say, and here's a few more slices for the next couple of days. But he does give sufficient for the day if I ask for it. I truly believe that. And then it's up to me to use that bread to take care of the precious gift of sobriety. And I'm responsible to do that. Each day that he gives me, I'm responsible to do that until bedtime. I was affected physically, mentally, spiritually, socially, and emotionally with this disease. Physically, I fared out pretty well, even though there were times I tried to arrange my own physical death. I used to take the car, go across the bridge, up the parkway, pull over, and I'd say, when that car is gone, when those people move away, I'm going to run this car over the embankment because I don't know what's the matter with me. And then I'd say, well, I'll go get a drink. I'll come back another time. So I was not to die physically. But, you know, there are other ways of dying. Maybe you can identify with them. I suffer the death of my values. I suffer the death of my integrity. I suffer the death of everything that I stood for as a woman and everything I stood for as a sister. All those areas of my life died. Outwardly, I looked pretty good. I held a job. I did it fairly well. I tried to keep up with my responsibilities. And above all, during this time, above all, I always said my prayers. And many of you have shared with me along the journey that you thought you missed the boat because you didn't pray enough. I prayed enough for you and all belonging to you. So this disease of alcoholism must be so great, and indeed it is, that something as powerful as prayer of itself will not take care of it. And yet we say about prayer, prayer is a path where there is none. When all else fails, pray. But I don't believe you can pray your way for your alcoholism. I believe you have to add something else. And it goes like this. Pray and row the boat. And this beautiful way of life that we are called to enables us to do both, to pray and row the boat. I denied that alcohol was my problem. I was somewhat relieved when I learned that denial is the major presenting symptom of alcoholism, and that when you are in denial, you are not in touch with the reality of the situation. And there were many times that I exercised the denial. For example, my mother was in the hospital having a total hip operation. She was there a long time. The operation was not as perfected as it is today. And I went every single day to be at my mother's bedside, because that's where a good daughter should be. And it's interesting how we affect the people on the other side of the coin. My mother would say, "If you don't come tomorrow, it'll be just fine." Not being in touch with reality, my interpretation of that was, wow, there she is with all her pain, and she's thinking of me. And then I'd say to her, "Well, I have to be here to talk to the doctors and the nurses, and believe you me, you're going to get the care that you deserve." And she'd take her little finger rosary, and she'd roll her eyes. Now, I have just one sister, and she's also a sister, a member of my own community stationed in New York at the time. And during my active alcoholism, my sister secretly wished she had joined a missionary community and lived in South America. It's very hard to be proud of a sick, untreated alcoholic. I know that today. I didn't know it then. So my sister came to visit my mother, and she gave me a little wink to come outside. We went outside the door. And my sister's very tall. She towers over me. She looked down at me. She put her finger like this. You know how they do it. And she said, "Why? Why would you come to this hospital at 4 o'clock in the afternoon drinking?" And I was just about to give a homily when it dawned on me that we had been down this road many times before. And I made up my mind that I wasn't going to say a word. And to the best of my recollection, not a word did I speak. But being a typical alcoholic, and that's all that I am, is a typical alcoholic. You know, I could identify with the song, maybe you can too. First you say you will, and then you won't, you know. So I didn't want to break my word to myself, so I didn't speak. I found another way. And I took my right hand, which was the more powerful of my two, and I belted her. And two nurses came running down the hall, and they are yelling, "Sisters, sisters." They were not calling us sisters because we were the duty girls. But we were dressed very much like sisters used to dress. Some still dress today. My veil was on the floor. Hers was someplace else. Utter chaos on the sixth floor of this very large hospital in New York City. People are starting to gather. Now, I'm sure the people up close, they could have been saying to one another, or maybe they couldn't even say it. Maybe it was all in here. Oh, I know what that is. I live with that kind of stuff. And the people in the back, they could very well be thinking, "Oh, it must be a TV show, movie, you know." So where there is one of us, just one, sick, untreated alcoholic, mass confusion. I know that today. I didn't know it then. Now, I had a couple of concerns going on in my head up here. Interesting, I did not have the concern. Maybe I shouldn't have belted her. Nor did I have the concern. Maybe I shouldn't have had those last couple of drinks before I came down here. Uppermost in my mind, if only she hadn't screamed. That's how we got this gathering. And the other thought I had was my purse had fallen onto the floor, making it rather loud as it fell to the floor. And so I was preoccupied. I wasn't too concerned about the couple of dollars in the purse. I have a vow of poverty. I kept it quite well during this time. I was very concerned about the pint of holy water in the purse. One pint of Christian Brothers brandy. And so first things first. When I can steady as you go here and get down there, I'm going to get my bottle and be gone. Because I needed that next drink more than those nurses on the sixth floor. Now, there's only one word to describe somebody who'd be in that position. And I had to go through a lot of other descriptions. And if there's anyone here in this gathering who still sees themselves in this first grouping, I make the suggestion that you leave that thought here. Don't take it out of here with you. Because you're not being fair to yourself. I had to go through bad, hopeless, weak-willed, sinner, you should know better. I had to beat myself with all of that. But the way I would describe someone who'd be in the position that I was in today would be sick, unwell, not playing with full deck. That's respectful. Or I heard a fellow one night at a meeting, he described himself. He said he was a quart low. I heard another fellow another night, he said he had a photogenic mind, he just never had any film in the camera. But I had to go a ways before I could see myself as sick and unwell. If you drink and you drive, you might have an accident or two or three, depending upon your circumstances. It was an insult to even show on your face that you might drive us home. I brought you here, I bring you home. So I was always behind the wheel of the car. My first accident, July of 70, my good friend, Sister Rose, was in court over the dismissal of a teacher from her school. Rose was the principal of the school, and this was a big case in the Archdiocese of New York. It was unheard of in 1970 that a sister would be taken into court. That has changed in recent times. Some of them are there every day of the week. Now, Rose had a lawyer appointed by the diocese, and I said I will be in court to see that he does his job. I felt that was my role as close friend. Interesting how we affect the people on the other side of the coin. The night before the so-called trial, Rose called me up, and she said, Maurice, please, don't come to court. Not being in touch with the reality, my interpretation of that was, wow, there she is with all her pain, and she's thinking of me. Well, I have heard Rose share her story in that marvelous and wonderful program that parallels ours, that of Al-Anon. And indeed, she was thinking of herself, and rightly so. I didn't want to be a source of trouble. I said to Rose, listen, maybe you're right. I'll go to my classes, but I'll be downtown around lunchtime. I'll take you to lunch, you'll brief me, and I'll advise you for the afternoon session. And I know today, to be rid of me, she said, fine. Well, I was in graduate school, and I went to my classes, and I drove well-fortified from the north end of the city to the south end of the city. I was to get to the Wall Street section of my city. It was 5 minutes after 12 lunchtime, a working day in Wall Street, and the weather was clear. Those are the things they tell you at the top of the police report. A United States mail truck happened to get in my way, and I smashed into it. And when the policeman came on the driver's side, first words out of his mouth, sister, you couldn't miss it. Every piece from stem to stern. Probably on that day, I probably looked a little like, you know, probably the flying nun or the blue nun. And the very next thing the policeman said was, sister, could you have been drinking? I'm a great fan of New York's finest, And I wondered for a fleeting moment how this man got on the police force. And I proceeded to tell the officer how I saw it. I lost control of the car because I was so upset about this court case. Well, I went into a blackout, pass out, as was my custom, and I woke up in a convent a short distance away. I woke up in a strange bed. I didn't know where I was. It was not my custom then, it's not my custom today, to wake up in strange beds. It's obvious you have your story. Drunk or sober, I always woke up in my own bed. But at a time like that, we all have the same tricks of the trade. Where am I? What happened? And how do you get out of here? I could hear Rose talking to another sister through a partially open door. We didn't know this other lady. And I tiptoed over to see if I could get a handle on this. And I got to the door just as the other sister, who was very excited and very upset, she was going like this to Rose, and she said, "Your friend is on pills or she's drinking, and in order to help her, you are going to have to hurt her." Oh, I thought that was the poorest advice I had ever heard. So I went back to bed to get a little rest to handle Rose, who came in and asked the usual question, "What happened?" And I told her I lost control of the car because I was so upset about the court case. Now, when I was actively drinking, and long before I was drinking, and once in a while today, but not as much, I had what I call reverse thinking. Mountains were molehills and molehills were mountains. I was always on a different wavelength. Even as a little kid, you know, the other kids in the neighborhood, they'd have their right foot out. I always had my left out, you know. And I continued that well into adulthood, and alcohol came along and complicated all of that. The car that hit the mail truck was in my mother's name, and my mother didn't know about the accident. I mean, I had the car fixed, back out on the road. 3 weeks had passed. Every time you talked to Rose, she had the same question. "When are we going to tell your mother about the accident?" "Never." "Why do you want to tell my mother?" You know, you get that reverse thinking. "Well, the car's in her name. So what? It's fixed." I thought we were getting on with our lives. Then the fears that set in for a sick, untreated alcoholic. What if Rose tells your mother? So I called Rose up one night, invited her out for supper, my treat. Took her to a little restaurant, leaned across the table in the restaurant, and I said the following. "If you dare to tell my mother about the accident, someday you will come out of your convent. I will be sitting in a car. And when you cross the street, that will be it. That is called threatening someone's life." Now, I always share that in my story. Now, once in a while, somebody asks about it. The first time, many, many years ago, we had a friend of ours at the meeting one night as a guest. She came to hear me share, and at the end, she came up, and she pushed everybody aside. She said, "I have to ask you this question." I said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" She said, "Do you really think you would have run over Rose?" I said, "Gosh, no one had ever asked me that question prior to that moment." And I said, "Let me tell it to you this way. Of myself, no. I wouldn't hurt a fly. Without a drink in me, you wouldn't even know I was around. I was like part of the woodwork, part of the drapes. I mean, what was I anyway but a big nothing?" So I stayed in the background. Which I know today is an extreme. I wasn't able to take my rightful place. It just wasn't to be part of my story. Or part of Rose's. That I would run her over. Had another accident, took 5 parked cars with me. Total 3, damaged 2, plus my own. Policeman was a different sort of fellow. Real nice chap. He had a clean linen handkerchief patting my brow. Sister, I'm going to take care of everything. But he said, we have this report. He said, could you tell me a little bit about what happened? I said, the dog. Where's the dog? And then he said to me, would you happen to know the color of the animal? The disease was progressing rapidly. And one day I got a call from my boss, and she invited me up to see her. And in those days, if you were sent for, it was because you were in trouble or there was a special assignment that only you could do. So I'm driving up. And this is my thinking. I have enough to do. So we get together. We have a little chit-chat. She says, Maurice, I'll get to the point. Some of the sisters are saying that you drink too much. Now, in those days, when the superior, the head of the community, spoke, you listened. You didn't dare ask a question. I asked a question. I said, where are they? And I guess she wasn't used to having people ask her questions. She got a little nervous and she said, they don't want to be mentioned. I said to myself, they feared for their lives. And you know, as I look back now, in a very, very sick way, on the negative side, I was into one of our steps. Made a list. Of all people who had harmed me, and asked God to be rid of them. And I sat there writing one contract after another. And then I said to her, well, do you really know anything about me? And she went over to a file and she took out a folder and she peeked in and she said, oh, she said, I didn't know that you did this. And isn't this wonderful? How when you got this award and you're doing this in the diocese? Oh, she closed the folder and she said, you know, Maurice, this is terrible. Well, we agreed on that one. She said, I know one thing for sure. I will never, ever again believe this about any of our sisters. I said, that's a good policy to follow. She gave me an apology and off I went. And as I walked back to the car, I had one thought and one thought only. She will never, ever send for me again. She never did. Next time she arrived, unannounced, and put me away. I was angry and resentful during this time. Angry with God, first and foremost. I'd given my life to God. What do you want from me? I love the word relationship. And I learned about relationship from you, the people in the rooms. Prior to meeting you, trying to make it with God, whoever that was. Words in a book, sit up straight, kneel up straight. You'll never do it right anyway. And I did the best I could, and you know, God accepted that. But you know, he keeps calling us to change and to grow. That's what this process is all about, because he knows that's in our best interest. And today, it's very different. My relationship with God. So I had those extremes. Words in a book, sit up straight, kneel up straight. And then when I had one drink in here, it was taking God on. and you don't need me, well, I don't need you. I never said, I'm God. But you know, if I don't need someone bigger, greater, outside of this lady here, I wonder who I think I am. And that was my thinking at that time. So the anger turned into another drink and another bottle. And I went through the depression stage. We drink to be happy, and for some reason it makes people like us unhappy. Cannot identify with social drinking, didn't like the taste of alcohol. I was in the convent many years before I began using alcohol. My father passed away in 67. And I can say quite comfortably today that my father was to receive the gift of sobriety in a somewhat different manner than I received it. He received it when he looked eyeball to eyeball into the eyes of God. And upon my father's death, I had a pain that I couldn't describe to anyone. Well, they wouldn't expect me to have that kind of pain. And I reached for alcohol. Oh, and for a few hours, it was great. And I went from not drinking at all to the morning drink, to the mid-morning, to the noontime, to the early afternoon, to the late afternoon, and well into the night. And I was the first one up in the morning. I was the best teacher in that school. And if you gave me an assignment, I took care of it. So I was using alcohol to lift me out of a depression upon my father's death. And of course, drinking alcohol while depressed adds misery to misfortune. And the bargaining stage, you do this for me and I'll do that for you. And I did all the bargains with God. And I couldn't keep my end, because after we set it up, I'd reach for just one drink. One bargain I like to share on, when I got into bed one night, and I just got into bed with my rosary beads in one hand, as was my custom, hanging on to my sheets with the other hand, and all of a sudden I feel I have to get up and drink again. And for the first time I said to God, please don't let me drink anymore tonight, I'm so tired. Well, you know how the story goes. The rosary beads go to the floor and the covers get pushed back. And you get up and you crawl along the floor and you get your hiding spot. You get your bottle. And you take another drink. And on that particular night, it was one of the few times I didn't go into a blackout right away. And after I took that drink, something I didn't want to do, and I had asked God to help me, I beat that floor and I doubted the existence of God. How could a God who loved me, a God I'm to relate to as Father, I just asked you to help me. I bet there's no God. Someone has said, and well said, that Bowery and Skid Row can be a state of mind as well as a place. That cold, isolated, complete cut off from God, self, and others. No spirituality is how I would describe it today. And that's what I experienced that night. And the other thing I cried out at the top of my lungs, isn't there anybody anywhere who knows what I'm going through? Well, I didn't know you were up the street and around the corner, a few miles away, going through the same thing. Someone wrote a book one time about alcoholism and gave it the title The Lonely Sickness, because each one in the throes of it says, there's nobody. Nobody knows what I'm going through. I'm sure mighty glad that somewhere along our journey in this beautiful fellowship, in this way of life, that God saw fit that we would find one another. And I believe it is God who has arranged our meeting. C.S. Lewis says in one of his writings about relationships, he talks about relationships in general, and he says it's as if God says to the people in the relationship, you have not chosen one another, but I, God, have chosen you for one another. And if you think of the relationships that you have in this fellowship, would you of yourself have chosen those people? Or was it not all arranged? I like to think it was arranged. So today I make bargains, deals, promises, commitments, and I follow through. I attribute that to one fact and one fact only. I don't drink alcohol while I'm sober. Very significant in Maurice's life. And the final stage is acceptance. Holy Week, Easter week of 1971 were horrendous. The disease was progressing rapidly. And it all came to a head because I had two do-gooders in my life. I had a lot of do-gooders in my life, people who would talk to me about my drinking, and I just blew them away. But then I had these two, namely my sister and my good friend, Rose. And they blew the whistle, and they turned me in to the boss that I had convinced some time ago that this trip was not necessary. And they brought the boss, my superior, to my mother's home. And she said to me, "Maurice, I want you to stay with your mother. Don't go back to school tomorrow." This was at the end of the Easter vacation. And she said, "We'll be in touch." And we met again, and they did on me what is written up in the professional literature, of which I'm a strong advocate of. They did the process of intervention. They ask you next to nothing. And they make decisions about your life. And she spoke in past tense. She said, "Arrangements have been made. And they're expecting you in Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois." And she said, "You could go Friday or Saturday." This was a Wednesday. And I figured, well, I'll be dead by Saturday. I'll go Saturday. And then I got real close and I looked into her eyes and I saw how decent she was, that she was giving me options. I saw them in her eyes. Go willingly or unwillingly. And I have no problem in sharing with you, and this is my experience, strength, and hope, that left to my own devices, I believe I would be a statistic today. And so I went out to Lutheran General Hospital for what they said was going to be a 28-day stay, and I figured I'll go out, spend a few hours, I'll come back on the next plane. And when I got out there, I met you. I was only there but a few minutes when it was obvious to me why you were there. And you began sharing with me immediately, saying terrible things about yourself, beating yourself up unmercifully, but you always finished by saying, "Sister, you shouldn't be here. You're not like me. Now, anybody who thinks like I do is going to be my friend." So we became fast friends because we could agree on that last point. Then I figured, well, you were all so nice to me. What the heck? Maybe I'll get a rest. So by the end of the first week, I'm not one to sit around idle. I was a therapist. And you would seek me out and ask me all these questions because you didn't understand your counselor, you didn't get it at the meeting, you didn't understand the lecture. Ask Sister. She knows everything about everything. Now, we had one free hour. Well, you know, they put it on the schedule, they call it free, then they tell you what to do with it. And we were to stay in our rooms, read, write, listen to tapes, etc. Dutifully, every day I did as I was told. I tried. I'd go in, I'd set up my table, my kit, all my stuff, and I'd be there just a few minutes when I'd pitch the whole thing up in the air, and I'd go to the wall, And I'd bang my head on the wall, yelling and screaming at God, why me? I've given you my life, and this is what you've done to me. And sometimes there'd be blood pouring out. My roommate would run out, and she'd say, she's at it again, she's at it again. They'd come in, clean me up, calm me down. I was so angry with God. Today, and frequently, I still ask the same question. I ask it of God. Why me, God? I no longer ask God, why me? Why am I an alky? I'm not interested. Time is precious. This is the most important day of my life. This is the only time I can deal with. I want to use it in a positive way. And the last time I asked God, why me, God? Why am I sober? Since most people don't receive this gift. It was just a few minutes before I came up here. And I said, tell me one more time. And he does, and he answers very loud and very clear. And he says pretty much the same thing to me all the time. He says, Maurice, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. And he says, Maurice, many are called to the disease of alcoholism. Very few. Very few are chosen for the gift of sobriety. And I say, well, why me, God? I buried 9 people on both sides of my family from this disease. Why me, God? And he says, well, Maurice, make your little chart. He lets me make a little chart. I headed alcoholism, and I put a simple line down the center, and on this side of the chart, I put all of us who are in recovery. I think the last number I saw from World Service was 2.4 million. But on this side of the chart, we put all of those who are still out there. You wouldn't even see us. I find that awesome. To be on that side of the chart. And so I say to God, why me, God? Why am I sober, since most people don't receive this gift? And he says, well, Maurice, how do you see death? I see death as a person's work is finished and they're called home. We're all dying of something. And I believe you go to God when your assignments are complete. And not a second before. Whether you're 2, 22, or 102. Whether you die in your sleep, explosion, gunshot, AIDS, alcoholism, suicide. That's the cause. I see that as a secondary. I believe the first one takes place when your work is finished. That's my opinion. Certainly, if it's someone in my life, I do my grieving and my yelling and screaming and how come God and the loss. But I have to go one more step and say, well, her work was finished. His work was finished. Now, untreated alcoholism is 100% fatal. Most people who have the disease of alcoholism die of the disease of alcoholism. And then there's this 2.4. What's that all about? The death is interrupted because the work's not finished. And what is the work? Oh, it's not just any work. It's a specialized work. It's to carry a message. It's to walk with. It's to pass it on. It's to help other people take care of their precious gift of sobriety. And there are many ways that we carry a message. And from the moment that the plane set down at the airport Thursday night, and the two beautiful ladies that were waiting for Rose and myself, and from that moment on, right up until this moment, in so many ways, the message has been carried. Something as simple as the gal who sat all morning out there with the shirts. And I said to her as I walked by, I said, "Oh, you're here. Nobody here with you." And I said, "Well, you're by yourself, but you're not alone." And the message was carried to me. In so many ways this weekend. Sometimes we think the only way to carry a message is to pontificate at a podium. That's one way. So many ways was this message carried this weekend. And that's the way it works for us. And so when you really stop and think about it, and sometimes we lose sight of this because of what happens as we continue on our journey. It's not easy at times. And our attitude changes, and big deal, so I'm sober, but let me tell you what's going on. And it's hard sometimes. And things come along, persons, places, and situations, and they touch upon the precious gift of sobriety. And so every once in a while, it's a good idea to stop and ask the question, am I in touch with what is the precious gift of sobriety? That God went so far as to interrupt my death because my work is not finished. Now, there may be people out there today who will be saved from death, and I believe their work is not finished, but I don't know their work. I believe ours is defined. And so very late in the fourth week, I came to grips with this, and I left the facility with a prescription to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and these were the words of my counselor. He said, if you are faithful to the prescription, you will only have to come back here as our guest. And I said, I won't make you any promises. I'll see what I can do. And by the grace of God and faithfulness to Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or any substitute since that April 17th, 1971. I would not be so bold as to tell you I've had my last drink. If I thought I would never drink again, perhaps I wouldn't be as faithful. I received the bread for today because I asked for it, and I have sufficient for the day, and we'll see what happens tomorrow. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did the old one, too. I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I didn't like it one bit. And towards the end of my first year, sitting at a meeting one night, I heard a speaker say that he learned that unless he put those 12 suggested steps into his life and made some changes, he could very well lose his sobriety. And I waited because I was sure he was going to say, we don't mean that for the little sister there in the third row. And the guy never said it. And I knew why I was so miserable. I had not changed. But I was doing all I could do at that time. And then I was to go into another phase. The essence of all growth is a willingness to change for the better and an unremitting willingness to shoulder whatever responsibility this entails. I can't have it both ways. No change, no recovery. But it's not a hit and miss. There is a design for living that has been given to us. And little by slowly, chipping away and using those tools for change, major changes have taken place. The first is the intellectual change that has taken place. I had thinking that was either a 1 or a 10. That's called extreme thinking. And to be the extreme in anything, something is lacking. I had thinking that went ready, fire, aim. I was paranoid in my thinking. I could identify with the gal I heard one Saturday night at a spiritual weekend where we were, And she said she knew she was paranoid when she felt the car in front of her was following her. I had what I call postage stamp thinking. I could never see the broader picture. I wasn't interested in anyone else's opinion. And we talked about that. And you said, you know, use these tools for change. And you'll be able to broaden the picture. And you'll get out of that postage stamp thinking. And you'll learn about 2 to 9. And you'll get away from the 1 and the 10. And while I can still have my opinion today, I give people permission to see things the way they want to see them. I find that very freeing. Never knew that. And so the intellectual change, conversion, has taken place. And then the moral conversion. I couldn't keep up with my value system. The disease wiped it away, and that bothered me. And so we talked about that, and you said, hey, hang in. Use those tools for change. And little by slowly, you'll be able to put first things first and second things second. And when you're wrong, you'll be able to promptly admit it. And you'll be able to practice those principles in all your affairs. And you'll be able to practice those principles and you won't have affairs. And little by slowly, the moral conversion has taken place. And then the spiritual conversion. I had a lot of religion when I came. You couldn't miss it. It came out my eyes, ears, and nostrils. My room in the convent looked like a little Catholic gift shop. So one thing I had to do was come back from the extreme with religion, because to be to the extreme in anything, something is lacking. And then I had to get in touch with the spirituality. And when I asked you for a definition, you told me it was relating to self, the other person, and to God. And as soon as I heard relating to self, I said, it'll never be for me. There's nothing there. And then you told me what Dag Hammarskjöld said. Very powerful in my life, his words. The space that needs to be explored is the inner space. And that what I was looking for was not out there, but in here. That I was not deprived. It's just with my history and my story and the disease I never got in touch with. And little by slowly, you helped me to get in touch with what a marvelous and wonderful lady I am. I'm not alone in that. And if I have a thrust, it's to help people get in touch with that. Because it was so important for me. Because I couldn't do well in the second part of the spirituality, relating to others, when I had nothing going here. Because this is the one I take to the relationship with the other people. And then I would sit before God and project onto God the nothingness that I saw here. And I had difficulty with God. So by working and getting in touch with all that is in here, we have not been deprived, I believe. It's just with our history, our story, we didn't get in touch with it. But you hang in with this way of life, this design for living, and little by slowly, you get in touch. And then there's a difference in the relationships with the others. And then you get a little more comfortable with God as you understand God. And it helps you to have a life-giving, healthy, meaningful spirituality. All three areas need attention. And so there's been a spiritual conversion in my life. and spiritual poverty, as I describe it, has changed into spiritual wealth. And those 12 suggested steps, that design for living, helps us to keep those three things in place. The relationship with self, the relationship with the other person, and the relationship with God. And that's the spiritual conversion. I wasn't walking tall for a while. And today I walk very tall in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the third thing that God gives, I believe, when he gives the gift of sobriety upon the interruption of our death, he says three things. One, he says, I'm interrupting your death because your work is not finished. Carry a message, walk with, pass it on. Help other people take care of their gift. Secondly, you will share relationship with these people. They will come into your life and you will come into theirs. And third, he says, with this gift of sobriety, I give you your dignity. Walk tall. I learned from you, I am not my record. I am not my behavior. And you are not either. And a good technique that I use sometimes is to separate the behavior from the person. Because we get all caught up in the behavior and we lose sight of the marvelous and wonderful person that you are. And we keep working on the behavior through the process. And while that's going on, wow, you walk tall. I close with words that I picked up along the journey. They kind of sum up some of what I've been sharing this morning. And the first piece, I read it many, many, many years ago, and it says, through no virtue of ours, we have somehow been chosen, snatched back from a grave, from degradation, and clothed again in the robes of human dignity. May we never underrate or take for granted that gift of sobriety that is ours. And the other one I like to share, it kind of sums up what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And it comes from the chapter from the big book, Me, an Alcoholic. Here I found an ingredient that had been lacking in any other effort I had made to save myself. Here was power. Here was power to live to the end of any given day. Power to have courage to face the next day. Power to have friends. Power to help people. Power to be sane. Power to stay sober. And then I leave you with the very short version of Maurice's story. Sometime they're going to invite me for the short version. I'll go anyway. Perhaps you can identify with it. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And all I ask of you is to remember me as loving you. Thank you so very, very much.